Oral History Program of Foundation for Iranian Studies, interview with Mr. Ernest Oni, interviewer Sayed Ali Reza Nasr, May 29, 1991, Washington, D.C. Mr. Oni, let us begin this session by with the events of 1963-64, the riots that were precipitated by the status of forces law and the white revolution, and your own impressions of those events.
Of course, I was in Tehran at that time,
mm-hmm.
and the I think the intensity of the demonstrations took almost everyone by surprise. Perhaps not so much surprise at the fact that there were demonstrations, but at the fact that they were as intense and apparently as well organized as they were. I don't know even now any details about how or who organized them or who led them, but they obviously were well organized, not just a mob that arose spontaneously.
There is charges that General Bakhtiar was involved in this.
I know. I don't know. I don't know for sure. I heard the same sort of things that you did. I know there was a lot of publicity to the effect that Egypt was involved, and that Egypt had provided funds. General Pakhavan told me that, and I saw this later in the newspaper, I believe, that a Lebanese, I've forgotten his name, was arrested coming from Egypt carrying large sums of money. He was arrested at the airport. And he was carrying large sums of money, ostensibly for the to pay for the rioters. And remember also that Iran and Egypt were not on very good terms at that point. I was talking to General Pakhavan right at that time, and I mentioned this, and he said, "Yes, that was the official line." He said he wasn't completely sure of that himself, because the man that was arrested was a well-known money smuggler and had been in and out of Iran several times. He said, of course, the fact that he was a money smuggler might have made him a logical choice to bring in funds for the riot. Publicly, however, General Pakhavan followed the official line. I don't know that it was ever resolved one way or the other. The fact that this well-known money smuggler showed up right at the time of the riots is sort of perhaps circumstantial evidence. I think at the same time there was a clandestine broadcasts from Egypt over, I think it was called the Free Voice of Iran, Sadaya Azadi Iran. Yeah.
Sadaya Azadi
Iran. Yeah. And the main announcer or announcers on that affected a very kind of a mullah-like, a clerical-like pronunciation. It almost sounded, even in ordinary broadcast, almost sounded as if they were preaching a sermon.
Before this date, was there any evidence of collaboration between the clergy and the and Egypt?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
And was there, for instance, years you were in Tehran working with Sabah, was there any awareness that the clergy might be preparing for something disorganized, or there would be a potential source of trouble of this magnitude or of this nature?
nothing that they shared with us, nothing that Sadat shared with us.
So you were taken aback by this?
By the intensity, yes. There had been what were like rumors or reports that there would be some kind of demonstrations. This, after all, was during Muharram, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always an appropriate time for some kind of demonstration. So the fact that something happened was not surprising. But what was, I think, generally surprising was the fact that it was so strong, so large, so well organized. You know, groups split off and went to specific targets. It wasn't just a sort of a free-form rioting.
Had we here in the United States known beforehand that this would be this intense, would it have made them not to push for a status of forces law? Or?
You know, I was never sure whether the status of forces, how much that was a cause and how much it was an excuse. The status of forces was nothing really exceptional in terms of what it did. It followed very closely similar arrangements that we had with European countries. I think maybe the mistake was in pushing in the U.S. pushing for the status of forces. Why, I don't know, except it was a way of regulating the relationships that were already existing. I suspect that somewhere in the Defense Department or maybe the State Department, some of the lawyers were uncomfortable by the fact that that there was no formal agreement as to the status of all the people that were there. From my point of view, I don't remember the details, but from my point of view, it was not an exceptional thing to negotiate. It was not an exceptional kind of an agreement to negotiate because, as I said, there were similar agreements with most of the European countries, and I think also Turkey, perhaps, where there were substantial numbers of military personnel present. There was opposition in the Majlis to it, rather strong opposition in the Majlis, where it was, I think, equated with the old capitulations.
Mm-hmm.
Although if you looked at capitulations as compared to what was provided for in the status of forces, that, you know, were quite different. But it's a perception rather than the facts that are important in a case like this.
There was interesting, I suppose, in the crowd that some of the people who were involved in the street agitations of 1953 for the Shah were again involved in 1963-64 but against him. For instance, that famous Tayyip and
Tayyip from the
fruit market, yeah. Yes.
If I wanted to be real cynical, I would suggest that different people paid him at different times. As I said, that's more cynical, but put some money. You could rent a crowd in the bazaar almost any time you wanted it, and for any object. Uh, Of course, there might have been an additional thing working too, and that was that 53, the bazaar and the clergy generally were pro-Shah. By 10 years later, a lot of the bazaaris and the clergy had turned against the Shah. Mm-hmm. So that might well be, if not the whole explanation, at least a partial explanation.
But the army also reacted with great alacrity. Do you recall how and why? And because it particularly stands in contrast to the Shah and the government's behavior in the 1978-79 revolutionary process.
Well, if you remember, the first day, the first couple of days of the rioting in 64, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The security forces barely showed up at all. General Pakharan was by then the chief of SADAT, and he counseled the Shah to take a soft approach. Pakharan argued that by going out and trying to crush the mobs would only inspire them to fight harder and be more intractable. This was what Pakharan himself told me, that he had advised the Shah to take the soft approach and conciliatory approach. But after a day and a half or so of very destructive rioting, it looked like the soft approach was not going to work as Pakharan had believed it would. And it was about that point that the Shah deserted Pakharan's position and asked Nasiri, who was then chief of police, to take over and clean out the crowds, which he did. And it was at that point, after Nasiri took over, that the troops came out and dispersed the crowds.
What was the general reaction to both the nature of the riot and the way in which the government reacted, say, in the agency? How was the entire episode read and interpreted?
How it was analyzed and reported back here, I don't know, because I wasn't here.
You were there.
Mm-hmm. I think generally it was seen as a serious challenge to the Shah, but he had had a number of serious challenges in the past, nothing quite as dramatic as this. But the speed with which it was put down, the writing was put down, in spite of the initial day and a half when Pakharan was counseling a soft approach, the speed and what looked like the finality, I think this was taken as simply another indication of the fact that the Shah was on top of the situation. When he wanted to take strong action, he had the ability to do so, and was willing to do so. The fact that Khomeini was arrested and finally exiled, I believe merely backed up, supported the feeling that Bush had everything under control. I don't believe that there was a realization that this was a definitive demonstration of the clergy's power. For one thing, although we had from some of our sources information and sometimes actual texts of sermons that Khomeini had been preaching against the status of forces, for example, against the formation of the Rasakhi's party, and a variety of other things. We had these sermons, we could read them and see what Khomeini felt and what he was saying. I don't believe that there was a feeling that this was a long-term problem or a long-term danger. It's one of those things that happen from time to time, demonstrating the clerical opposition to the Shah's reforms, which wasn't a surprise because everybody knew that the clergy, and indeed some of the National Frontists joined our nationalists, joined in, and some of the leaflets that they put out. It just wasn't perceived as a long-term danger. And of course it was another 14, 15 years before it did.
At that time, was there this perception that the clergy, having demonstrated its ability and potential, would, given the climate of Cold War, as it was in Iran, that it could now play into the Soviet-American rivalry in Iran, and it could become a useful place for anti-Shah or pro-Soviet or these constellation of forces to operate through?
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's easy in hindsight,
right,
to see all those things, but if our foresight was as good as our hindsight, we'd have a lot of problems. I think it was simply seen as a clergy demonstrating as graphically as they could their opposition to reform. And up to that time, I don't recall that there was any serious assertion on the part of the clergy that the clergy should be the rulers of Iran.
For instance, Khomeini, sort of his activities followed once he left Iran. I mean, did you continue to look at his sermons and what he was up to in Iraq? Or was the issue just put to rest?
The issue was put to rest. Let me take a phrase out of something that I wrote here. I remember what it was. This was a book review.
Mm-hmm.
I did it. I commented on that. At any rate, the lecture notes of an exiled Iranian clergyman speaking in a mosque in a provincial Iraqi city in 1969 hardly rated high, either as a news story or as a policy problem until very late in the game. Which I think explains it. I don't believe if I or somebody else had been interested in what Khomeini was doing or saying down there, that it would have been possible to mount an intelligence operation find out what he was going on. As I said,
and it was not evident that the competitors, like the Soviets, were making any intelligence.
No,
as far as the Cold War was concerned, that
no, it was not. I and one or two others sort of kept that in the back of minds, but we never turned up any anything very solid information. on it. I think, as I said earlier, there's something that we need to keep in mind here, and that was the attitude, kind of the ingrained approach of Americans, and I suppose most Europeans, toward clerical, toward religion. And that was, by and large, it was simply left out of any political equation. I think I mentioned earlier that, you know, we had, at least in the United States and to a large extent elsewhere in the European world, the separation is very sharp and is very much insisted on. So I think psychologically we were unprepared to see that the clergy, while they obviously had a great appeal to the masses, they had enough appeal that they could parlay this into political power. For the same reason, I think if I or any one or two other people had suggested that we try to recruit agents of the clergy in order to give us an inside view of what was going on, I think it would have been rejected by the superiors. Simply because, I can foresee a couple of arguments that would have been used against it. One, that it's a useless target. No. Put your clergymen talking to each other, talking to the masses, preaching sermons. What does this mean politically? Nothing. This would have been an argument against it. A second argument would have been more on a moral or ethical grounds, that it simply is not tolerable to try to subvert the clergy, subvert or even infiltrate them. This, I think, was part of our mindset, of our psychological mindset, that made it almost impossible for us after the demonstration of the clergy's power in 1978-79, it became obvious that this was precisely what we should have been doing as early as 1970. Should have been attempting to get some kind of sources in the clergy to have a better feeling of what was going on.
Other Western agencies did not have similar sources that at least, see, for instance, in 1953, the British had their own agents, sources of information, which when the time of crunch came, they could share with you, make a pool. Didn't this exist, that even if you weren't paying attention, maybe they were, and they would have information to pass on if you needed it?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer for sure. Either they no longer had sources in the clergy, or they had the information and didn't pass it on. Mm-hmm. I'm more inclined to the first view, because there was a rather free exchange of information that was considered of importance to both countries.
But on other issues, you would share information. So on military, on the Shah government, on bureaucratic changes, on these kinds of things, cooperation existed between Western agents.
Oh yeah, the exchange on a very on a high level. Although the British and the American ambassadors talked to each other on a regular basis, and they exchanged information and impressions.
I'll come to that later, yeah, since we're on this subject. James Dean in his book talks of you, as I'm sure you know, of that you did prepare reports and that they were so sort of looked down upon at CIA, and even they said that you were called deprecatingly mullah Oni.
Yeah. You should understand, we did a variety of different kinds of reports were produced. I have no idea what they are now or what they're called now, but there was a very high level report prepared for the president and his...
On regular basis? On regular basis?
Yeah, daily. Then there was another daily, generally called the bulletin, which was more widely disseminated, and it contained 8 or 9 of what was considered to be the most important events of the last 24 hours. Most of the time, Iran did not show up in that because it simply, there were too many other things that took priority. Then there was another sort of a lower classification, wider distribution, where you had a pretty free hand to write what you wanted. This was, I did a few things in there talking about the clergy, a little bit about organization. I tried to provide a bit of background for our readers. But this was only low-level publication, circulated mostly among the intelligence analysts, and served as, in other words, it rarely got up on a policy-making level. The policy-making level was served by the president's daily brief and by the bulletin. This lower-level publication circulated among the peons, if you like, among the peasants, the guys that were doing the work. And it was used as a way to kind of call attention to other animals, so interesting things that we had seen, and hey, did you see this, and what do you think? You know, this kind of thing. To put ideas and maybe draw reactions from some of the analysts and the other agencies. So this is where a few things that I wrote did show up. We had, and I think I mentioned this before, we had one source who was not a clergyman. He was a layman. He had good contacts among the clergy. At one time, he had published a religious magazine. And actually, he had become a source in, I think, 1952, 1953, as part of what was going on at that time. But no one was very interested in him in the later years, say in the 60s and into the 70s. He was still more or less available. But no operations officer saw him on a regular basis. The material that he provided was sometimes kind of fragmentary. And except for me, there was no one that was interested in reading the stuff. As a matter of fact, for a long period of time, 5-6 years, I thought he'd been taken. I thought he'd disappeared because I saw nothing from him. And then I discovered, quite by accident, in talking to one of the operations people, that he was still available. But he hadn't been talked to on a regular basis because there was no interest, or very little interest, in the kind of information that he could provide. Uh, when I heard he was still available, I did lay on some requirements and I got some information, some answers back, but I was the only one that I think that had enough interest to try to push this. I talked about it to various people about the, you know, about the clergy and problems. I guess that's where the business and Bill's book came from. I don't know who he talked to that he got that from. I didn't tell him that.
How many people at any one time, say in the 60s or 70s, would be working on Iran in CIA? Because you, only one, but you mentioned I was the only one of a number of people. You had one person in Tehran, which would be a station officer, and one analyst being yourself.
Yeah. There were people from time to time in INR, Department of State Intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Which is that State Department?
Yeah, who had some interest, you know, kind of an intellectual interest, more than an operational interest. There was a guy in the Department of, in the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency.
I see.
That followed Iran, at least part-time, and he had, again, sort of an intellectual interest in it, but again, not an operational interest.
But their interest would be more in the military.
DIA?
And DIA.
The function of DIA was to follow and report on primarily on military affairs. They sometimes reported on political situations of interest, because DIA's job was to keep Defense Department people informed, and, you know, like the Chief of Staff and Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence and things like that. The Pentagon people, officers and civilians, tended to read the DIA publications.
Mm-hmm.
So inevitably, the DIA analysts would sometimes report on political stuff, political situations, just as a way of keeping their superiors informed. Sometimes they simply reprinted material that we had published, that the agency had published elsewhere. They just lift it and publish it in their publications.
Mm-hmm. But in Tehran, you would have one person at the embassy who would do the interviews with your contacts and relay information.
Yeah, but he, you know, he may have been seeing and maybe five or six sources.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I don't think we've touched on, but it bears on this problem very directly, and that is that the agency or any other intelligence organization doesn't just go out and sweep up information at whim.
Mm-hmm.
There are very definite requirements that come from the policymakers that act as directives on what is going to be collected. For example, during this period of time that we're talking about, you know, preceding the revolution, say the 60s and 70s, the main things, the first priority things that were being requested were things like Iranian oil policy, where what was of interest was what the policy planning actually was, as opposed to what was said to be publicly. Michael, if you believe that what the Shah and NIOC, if you believe what Iran said their policy was, then you wouldn't have to collect anything secretly. But in a sensitive situation like that, you want to try to get other sources that you control to try to determine, is this policy indeed the actual intention? Then there was the problem of arms absorption. The Shah was buying a lot of weaponry. In spite of attempts that our military people and some of our political people made attempts to curb his appetite for this material, he had the money to do it. And he could buy material from Germany, from France, from Italy. He had the money to buy from anybody. So there was the problem of the capability of the Iranian military to absorb and where to use all this material that they were getting. For our military people, it was an important problem. So oil policy, arms absorption, there was interest in the Iranian capability to develop a nuclear industry. At the University of Tehran there was a center, and there was in the works plans to build nuclear reactors for power. This has been a high priority target worldwide for the United States because of the possibility of going from a nuclear generating capacity to the ability to build nuclear weapons. Okay, India and Pakistan, for example. We had no reason to believe at that point that the Shah intended to build nuclear weapons. But there was a very high interest in monitoring it for the capability to do so. At one time when we looked at the problem, say, sometime in the mid-1970s, we did a little further look at the problem, and feeling at that time was that even if Iran had started at that point to develop nuclear weapons capability, it would have been 10 years before it could have done it.
This is the sort of material you looked at.
Yeah.
So you're more interested in what the government was up to rather than how stable it is.
Yes. And again, I need to emphasize this, the three things that I mentioned, and perhaps one or two others, were the highest priority. Down about third or fourth priority, and I know this was the case because I put it in, was kind of broad statements like information on the clergy. A, leading figures. B, attitude toward the Shah and the reform program and things like that. Not that we didn't know what it was pretty much, but that's the kind of thing
you also did some work the extent of Soviet activities among the clergy. If you can say a little bit about that.
Yeah, much of the information that we had on that came, I believe, from that one source that I mentioned earlier, the layman with good contact in the clergy. And he provided some bits and pieces from time to time that we were able to, I was able to piece together. And what it showed was that the Soviet embassy had a very active program with among the clergy. One of the, I believe it was a cultural attaché. I can't tell you his name right now. I might think of it. These obviously were KGB people. He had regular contacts with some of the clergymen. He distributed beautifully printed copies of classical Iranian literature, poetry, beautifully printed copies of the Quran. I don't know where they were printed, I suppose. In Moscow, certainly you couldn't buy them in a Moscow bookstore at that time.
And
the propaganda line that this man followed in his conversation with the clergy was to compare this material that they were giving to the clergy with the kind of material that was available from the United States, the accent on the flood of things like Playboy magazine and similar magazines that were you could buy in almost any of the kiosks on the street. His line, this KGB type's line, being very obvious. Here's what the Americans are sending you. Obviously, it's designed to have a demoralizing effect on Iranians and Iranian youth, and then look at what we're giving you. Also, at least a couple of times, clergymen were invited to symposia and meetings in the Soviet Union.
And Sabat monitored this?
I imagine that they did. If they did not monitor it, they were certainly remiss in their duties.
And did your source provide any indication as to what was the clergy's reaction to the Soviet overtures? Were they receptive, indifferent, or?
Yes, apparently they were pretty receptive. One meeting that the Imam Juma of Tehran,
Mr. Imami,
went to one of those meetings apparently, and when he came back. Again, according to this source of ours, he expressed a great surprise and a great interest in the fact that Islam was so widely practiced and permitted to be practiced in the Soviet Union. So
even though he was a government appointed,
this was something that was. Surprising, at least to me, and anybody else that wanted to think about it. But it's indicative of the impact that the Soviets were able to make among even somebody like the Imam Juma. Obviously, he saw and heard what the Soviets wanted him to see and hear, because in those days, you just didn't move freely and talk freely with anybody you wanted. If you bumped into somebody on the street and stopped to talk to him, that was permitted because he can put on the street specifically for that purpose.
Let me ask you this. When the events of 63-64 finished, the faith of Khomeini, there is suggestions that the Mossad or the CIA had their own views as to what should be done with him, and that General Pakhavan was instrumental in getting a mere exile as opposed to a harsher punishment. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So far as I know, I can't speak for Mossad, obviously. So far as I know, CIA had absolutely no position on that. They seemed clear as a problem for the Shah to solve. Mm-hmm. And it was, as I suggested earlier, Khomeini was not seen as enough of a problem to warrant any position on the part of the U.S. or on the part of the agency. People start thought. Although Pakhavan was instrumental, at least this is what I gather from my conversations with him, he was instrumental in getting Khomeini exiled rather than some harsher punishment, which I think the Shah would have liked.
Was Mr. Alam a big mover in this whole episode? Again, it suggested that he was...
Amir Asadullah?
He was the counterpart, as you would, to Pakhavan, in the sense that he pushed for harsh response, as opposed to a docile one.
That doesn't surprise me, but I don't remember any particular thing at the time. But I would have thought that Alam would have followed whatever line that Shah was.
Did you see any effect on the Savak as a result of this?
On Savak?
On its mentality, on its operations, as a result of these riots and agitations? Thinking of its leadership, how they perceived their duty? Did it mold the organization in any sense?
No, I think now the next year, let's see. Let me get my years straight. These riots were in 63.
63, 64.
Yeah.
By the time the ordeal was over, it was 64.
At the time of Muharram,